Hello, welcome. For those of you who haven't been before, I'm Tom. It's great to have you here. I'm not our usual pastor. I'm just standing in. I'm one of the members of the congregation here. Our normal pastor's away today. Thank you for joining us, and for everybody else, welcome. Great to see you back. At this church, teaching the Bible and the Bible central to what we do. So now what we're going to have is going to be a bit of a talk just on the passage that we just had read. And hopefully that will, as we just sang in kind of a prayerful way, hopefully it will go into our hearts and maybe affect some of what we're doing. So today we're going to be looking at, as sure, John chapter 7. That'd be really helpful if you had that open in front of you. And today's main text, there's loads of narrative, lots of interaction, and there's not necessarily one main aim of the passage, but what we'll see, there's one overriding theme that should come out. It's what happens when people interact with Jesus. We might call it, in the way we would go about, maybe old school evangelism, or maybe what will happen where we share the gospel. We're going to see Jesus today. He's going to interact with lots of different people. He's going to be interacting with his brothers, kind of family members. He's going to interact with a large crowd. He's going to interact with some religious leaders, and he's going to interact with some temple guards, maybe modern day kind of police officers. And we're going to see the more he interacts with those people, the more people are going to be divided. They're going to move from a central, isn't he a nice guy, to maybe open hostility where they want to kill him, or maybe to believing actually he is the Messiah, someone who's come to save them. We're going to see that that happens only though when people interact with Jesus. It doesn't happen of their own accord. And we're going to see that people genuinely do become believers in Jesus as they interact with him. So that's what we're hoping to see today. So we're going to see that Jesus is polarizing. He's going to divide opinion. People do become Christian. And that happens just as we interact with him. But first of all, as we start to look at the passage, we're going to look at one key verse in there, which is, in fact, the one up there, verse 17. So I'm going to pray, and I'm going to start teaching. And Father God, I thank you so much for this passage. I thank you that we just have your words, and we can really see how you lived and shared what you want. And I just pray that as we go through this, I'll be faithful. Amen. Amen. So verse 17, it's kind of like a one to hang your hat on as we go through this chapter, one that Jesus kind of sets out for us. As we're going to see him interacting, we're going to see lots of people questioning and challenging. And he gives us a little bit of advice in verse 17, as you can see up on the screen, says, anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own accord. Seems every day, doesn't it, there's a new church leader from somewhere, maybe a church background different to yours, coming up with some new kind of teaching. Maybe you've heard recently someone, a bishop maybe, say something like, well, we wrote the Bible. We get to rewrite the Bible. And you think, where do we go with that? Well, Jesus comes to us as we start seeing being challenged with verse 17. And he says, what does he say? He says, anyone who chooses to do the will of God, that's the start of the qualifying thing. Now, what is it, the will of God? Well, fortunately, Pete preached us a little bit on this last week. It's actually, if you just go to look to the chapter just earlier, chapter 6 and verse 14. For my Father's will, that is God, is that anyone who looks to the Son and believes in him shall have eternal life. So God's will, the Father's will, is that we look to Jesus and we believe in him. So when we see verse 17 up on the screen, it says, anyone who chooses to do the will of God, that means anyone who looks at Jesus and believes in him. Okay, so as we see that, so qualifying statement that as Jesus starts off here is, should be something that we find really encouraging for everyone here who chooses to follow God, who chooses to put their faith in Jesus. It's not a qualifications qualification, it's not. You will find out if you've done so many Bible courses, if you've read through the Bible so many times. It's a faith qualification. So if you choose to follow God, Jesus is saying here, you'll be able to see what the will of God is. You'll be able to discern whether a teaching is from God. Now, that isn't saying the most complex theological arguments you'll understand straight away. But what it's saying is you'll understand or know some basic truths. You'll know, for example, as we go through, you'll instinctively understand, is Jesus a liar? I'd like to think that if you follow Jesus instinctively, you will know that he is not. Or is Jesus the Messiah? So any argument that comes forward that might say, Jesus is not the Messiah, Jesus is not the Christ, even if you can't see the logic yet, you will instinctively have the ability to say that's not a correct conclusion. And so what hopefully we'll see as we go through, we'll see that actually, as Christians here, you're really well qualified actually just deal and engage with people, just in the way that Jesus does, that you shouldn't be fearful or afraid. In fact, you'll find that most people in the UK don't even have a view of Jesus being a real character, a real person. You know, 40% of the UK actually believe that Jesus is a mythical character. So as you hold these views, you'll realise, and I'm hoping that you'll see, you'll be really encouraged. So there's no qualification of education. If you trust in Jesus, what Jesus is saying here, you'll see as we go through, you'll be well qualified. So start then. Has anyone ever seen The X Factor? You normally see there's a few people who come up on the live auditions. Someone comes up and, you know, the judge says to them, why are you here? What have you come for? And they say, you know what? I was in the karaoke down the pub a couple of weeks ago. My mate said to me, mate, you have got such a talent. And then next week we saw X Factor was coming to town and said, there's going to be big shows. There's going to be all the big judges, all the leaders. This is your chance. Take it, you know, and they were, you know, because he's showing off down the pub. And so we find it here. Quite a similar thing with Jesus, verse 4. His brother said to him, show yourself to the world at the end of verse 4. They want to encourage him, they want to get up. But you see the fingers with the brothers, they're not doing it in a nice way. You see verse 5, what's their kind of motive? It's not a positive one. For verse 5, for even his own brothers did not believe him. And so we see Jesus being encouraged by his brothers to go up to this festival. This big festival, the Festival of Tabernacles, one of the big three festivals. And yet they're not doing it out of a right motive. And we see it becomes a bit of a problem. Because they're saying to Jesus, you want to make a big splash? The big crowds are going to be here at this big festival. If you want to be anyone, the big religious leaders are going to be there. If you want to make a splash in the religious world, go and show yourself now. But they're not doing it out of a right motive. They'd seen these miracles that Jesus had done. They'd recently seen the feeding of the 5,000, just a chapter ago. They've seen him heal a paralysed man at the pool of Bethesda. And just over a year ago, they've seen him turn water into wine. And yet, instead of taking those on in a positive way, viewing him as a Messiah, they've started to question, maybe even be a little bit jealous. They're saying, go and show yourself. But how does Jesus respond, verse 6 to 10? He said, therefore Jesus told them, my time is not yet here. For you any time will do. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of its works are evil. You go to the festival. I am not going up to this festival because my time has not yet fully come. After he said this, he stayed in Galilee. However, verse 10, after his brothers had left for the festival, he also went up, not publicly, but in secret. Now, can you see the problem there? Imagine you're doing your one-to-one with your friend. You've been encouraged to do your gospel one-to-one. You can see there's a problem, isn't there? Jesus has said to his brothers, I'm not going to go up to the festival. And you arrive at verse 10, and he goes up to the festival once his brothers have gone. You can imagine maybe you're there doing your one-to-one with your friends, and they say, hang on a minute, I can see there's a clear problem here. It looks like Jesus has lied to his brothers. It looks like he just didn't want to go up with them. But I've said verse 17, think about as you deal with those, you might not see the answer clearly, but it says anyone who's willing to follow God. You know, God, is any conclusion that you could reach that means God is a liar an accurate conclusion? I'd like to think if you follow God today, that you would understand that is not an appropriate or an acceptable conclusion. God is not a liar, and we'll see later on actually he's in truth. So as we deal with these problems, you'll see that you are actually well qualified. So what's the answer then? Why is it that Jesus ends up at the festival? And he's just told his brothers he's not going to. Well, the answer is that the brothers didn't want him to go up from verse 4 just to continue God's work. They wanted him to show himself to the world. So what does Jesus say, verse 6? My time is not yet here. You might have recognised that phrase from before. Remember in chapter 2 at the wedding of Cana, when Jesus' mother asked him, there's a problem with the wine, can you help out with the wine? He says, mother, my time has not yet come. And again he says to his brothers, my time has not yet come. Now what does he mean by that? In the Bible, what we often see is Jesus, when he refers to his time, it means the time of his death and his resurrection, the time when he will show himself to the world. And in fact, we see as he approaches on the night before his death and his trial, he does say, my time is near, my time's coming, and my time then is now. So the reason he says to his brothers, I'm not going to go up, is not because he's saying, I'm not going to go up to the festival at all. He's saying, now's not the time to show myself to the world. And in fact, you can see timing, just as he said in chapter 2, here in chapter 7. My time is not here because you can do whatever you want because you are of the world, verse 7. But for him, it's key. Some critics have said before, this shows Jesus being really whimsical. You know, it's almost like He didn't want to go to the festival. His brothers had now gone up and he's sitting at home alone and thought, do you know what? Actually, maybe it would have been really good fun if I go up to the festival, so I'm going to go. But we see absolutely the opposite. We see Jesus' total commitment to the timing of who? Of his Father, God the Father in heaven. He could have gone up to the festival, he could have chosen to. But instead, he's so committed to God the Father's timing that he chooses not to. And so what happens? So once he goes up to the festival, we start to see him go up, don't we, in 10. And he goes up, but in secret. He doesn't want to show himself to the world. And so we arrive, we zoom forward to verse 11 to 13. We start to see what's happening at the festival. You can see there's a palpable buzz. Verse 11, 12 and 13. The end of verse 11. Where is he? And in 12, you can see all the crowds are whispering. It says, among the crowds there was widespread whispering among him. It seems that the festival is almost consumed with the talk, ironically, about God turning up. But of course, they're all suppressed, aren't they? The verse 13, no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the leaders. Maybe you've had that before. Maybe you've been in school and the teachers are trying to suppress something. I remember my final term at university in the canteen. It was tradition that we all had a food fight. And there was a little bit of excitement, but you knew all the leaders were trying to suppress it. You were talking about it. You weren't allowed to talk about it. You knew something was going to happen, but you didn't quite know what. You didn't quite know when. And so Jesus is there in the background. He can sense the excitement almost. And so we arrive at verse 14. And finally, it happens not until halfway through the festival. Did Jesus go up to the temple courts and he began to teach. And what did he teach? It doesn't say. And in many ways, that's more significant. It shows us whatever Jesus is teaching. Verse 15, it's amazing. The Jews there were amazed. They were amazed and said, how did this man get such learning without being taught? Whatever Jesus is teaching, it's absolutely, completely taken them by surprise. Now that sounds, verse 15, doesn't it? Almost a sense of ignorance, maybe a bit of snobbery. It's like, oh, he's been out in the far distant part of Jerusalem, or sorry, in Judah, up in Galilee, up in Israel. And he hasn't been at any of the big universities, he's maybe had a backward school education. But no, what they mean is, the Jews, the rabbis, they would pass down their instruction to each other. You'd come up to the main centres of teaching, and each rabbi would have their law passed on in their own school by a rabbi. And they're looking around thinking, well, I don't know any rabbis that have passed on any teaching to Jesus. This guy here has turned up with not any qualifications from anywhere. And yet he started to amaze them. It's not a point of ignorance on their part, it's a point of saying he really hasn't had any formal teaching, and yet his teaching has absolutely astounded them. And so what does Jesus say? Anyone? My teaching, verse 16, my teaching is not my own. Now that sounds almost kind of like a mythical surprise, as if it's a little bit not quite clear, but for them that would have been obvious. You know, of course, they're always not their own. They were all from their own rabbis. And so that was just a common sense statement for them. It comes from the one who sent me, verse 16. And the question is not, well, isn't that interesting? It's, well, who sent you? They don't know which person did. And so verse 17, anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. So he's making the big claim. He's not from any of the rabbis. His teaching is from God. He's speaking on God's authority. In verse 18, he continues, whoever speaks on their own does so to gain personal glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him. And then he challenges him, has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me? Why are you trying to kill me? It sounds funny, it sounds odd, doesn't it? Sounds almost disjointed, but the point is they had the law of Moses, and yet not one of them is following them. They're following their own rabbinic law. And so the main point that Jesus picks up on, how do I know that you're not following the law of Moses? Well, remember the Ten Commandments, the most obvious one present is, thou shalt not murder, and yet they're trying to kill Jesus, an innocent man. It's so clear, he's saying, I'm teaching truth from God, and you can't even follow the law of Moses. So in the right there, he's claiming, I've got teaching from God. Your teaching is from man and of your own accord. Now, how is it that we are going to take on that teaching for ourselves? I said at the start, didn't I, verse 17, the qualification of knowing Jesus' teaching and whether he's from God or not is not one of academic or your own preparation, but one of faith. But at the same time, there is a need for you to develop that own understanding. Have you ever had a teacher where you see the work and you go, oh yes, I recognise that, that's from that certain teacher? Or maybe you see football pundits and they'll be talking about maybe Jose Mourinho is a well-known football man and say, oh, this team, that's got just like a Mourinho team. And the reason they're confident in saying that, because they've seen so much football. Now, Paul writes in one of the epistles later on, it's time for you to move on from just having the spiritual milk and onto solid food. So while it is absolutely true, as soon as you start to trust in God and accept some of the basics, you'll be able to question what teaching is from God. There is an anticipation that you will kind of push on and develop a little bit. And how would we expect to do that? Well, it's to sit under Jesus. If anyone chooses to do the will of God, if you follow God, there is an expectation that you will take on some of that yourself. So what should that look like? Maybe that's a personal study. I don't know what most of your personal study is like, but are you doing a daily Bible study? Are you meeting one-to-one with another Christian? Maybe if you're a mature Christian, are you thinking about finding a less mature Christian and maybe doing a one-to-one study with them? And maybe you go to a small group, a Bible study group. If you're not sitting under that teaching, though, or not coming back to find that, how will you expect to develop and move on in teaching? That's what Jesus, I think, wants us to see. There is so much that we can learn from Jesus, but hopefully we'll push on and we'll see it. But it's not just for our own individuals, the church corporately. How can we think about the others around us and how can we encourage them? And like I said, maybe if you're a mature Christian, maybe you look out for a less mature, a new Christian, and think about going through a Bible study with one of those people. And so we reach that period where Jesus is saying, why are you trying to kill me? What happens? The crowd, verse 20, they say, you are demon possessed. Remember, not that long ago, they were saying, oh, he's a good man, this Jesus. They were excited about him coming. Who is trying to kill you, they say. And so Jesus replies, verse 21, I did one miracle and you are all amazed. Yet because Moses gave you circumcision, and he goes on. Now if a boy can be circumcised, verse 23, on the Sabbath, why can I not heal the whole body? You may remember the healing. We had a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the healing at the pool of Bethesda. There was a paralyzed man. He went here and Jesus got him to pick up his mat and walk. And the man was healed wholly and totally in body. The problem was, Jesus did it on the Sabbath. And he said to the guys here, hang on a minute, you're saying you can have circumcision on the Sabbath? Because if a baby boy is born on the eighth day, he'll be circumcised. Now, if it so happens that falls, the eighth day is on the Sabbath, it is okay to keep the law of Moses to circumcise him. After all, God has told the Jews to circumcise their boys and to perfect that body. They're happy to go against the Sabbath. They're happy to do some work on the Sabbath. Now Jesus is saying, you're saying you have a problem with doing the whole body. And so how does the crowd respond? Verse 25, they're starting to now really interact with Jesus. And we're going to see here how the crowd starts to divide and how some will start to believe. Verse 25, at that point some of the people of Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this the man they were trying to kill? Say, ah yes, we are trying to kill you. I forgot all about it. They've changed, they've realised. Here he is publicly speaking, verse 26, and they're not saying a word to him. Have the authorities concluded that he is his Messiah? So some guys in the crowd are starting to genuinely think, this could be the Messiah. They're starting to interact with Jesus. But what happens, verse 27? But we know where this man is from. When the Messiah comes, no one will know where he is from. What's the conclusion they're trying to draw? Jesus can't be the Messiah. Verse 17, anyone who chooses to follow the will of God, is it possible, reading this as a Christian, to draw a conclusion that Jesus is not the Messiah? I say that you guys are well qualified to deal with this. You know the answer, Jesus is the Messiah. And so what's the problem? Satan is starting to come in, as we see always, that from the very beginning in Genesis, he starts to sow a little bit of untruth, starts to try and show a little bit of discord. Maybe you remember in the Garden of Eden, did God really say? And so we find it here. See that verse 27? But we know where this man is from. When the Messiah comes, no one will know where he's from. Well, that is not true. But how does Jesus respond? He doesn't reply with a geography lesson or a history lesson. He gives them something so fundamental. Then Jesus, still teaching in the temple, "Yes, you know me and where I am from. I'm not here on my own authority, but he who sent me. You do not know him, but I knew him, and I am from him." He doesn't say, "Actually, I grew up here or I grew up there." He says, "You know where he's going to have to come from? The Messiah's going to have to come from God." And they can't deny that. "That's me." That's what Jesus is saying. "Hang on a minute. You're saying it could be." So what happens is they respond with a lie and Jesus responds with truth. And as they interact, we see people are divided. They start to vacate that middle ground. Maybe you get that in your own life as you interact with our friends. Maybe you hear things like, "Isn't the Bible written by Henry VIII for? Isn't just the Bible a load of Babylonian stories?" And you'll start to see, you know, where those points are going to conclude. But if you follow the will of God, you'll realise that those conclusions are inaccurate. The problem is sometimes it's hard, isn't it, as you start, maybe you have a little bit of a fear. I certainly get as you interact with your friends. Sometimes the hardest thing is just to say, "I don't know." But actually, if we look at verse 17, it often can be the most helpful. Because if we don't say, "I don't know," to our friends when we don't know, one, you may end up saying something you don't want to say, but also you might be showing your friend that actually to become a Christian, you need to have a certain level of knowledge rather than a certain level of faith, which of course is only a small amount of faith. And so it's important that as we deal with these, we are prepared to say, "I don't know." But as we see, what happens? We continue. Verse 30. At this, they tried to seize him. No one laid a hand on him because hour was still not yet come. Still, many in the crowd believed in him. Again, more people are starting to believe as they interact with Jesus. And they said, "When the Messiah comes, will he perform more signs than this man?" But the Pharisees heard this crowd, verse 32. And the chief priests and the Pharisees sent temple guards to arrest him. So we're starting to see the other end of the polarisation. And it might be the same for us as we interact with our friends, but Jesus is now facing arrest. Some of your friends will believe that. In fact, we see that in any survey, at least 20% of people who know a Christian in the UK would like to learn more about Christianity and in fact have some Bible study with their Christian friends. Some of your friends will want to hear this. And what happens as they continue to interact, they move on to the final day, verse 37. At this big festival, there's a special day of the collecting up of water. A long, long time ago, before there was a pool in Siloam, Jerusalem didn't have its own water supply inside the walls, which meant it was extremely vulnerable. Anyone knows, obviously, if you come under siege and don't have your own water supply, it's a bit of a problem. You're not going to be able to last a siege that long. And so they developed this pool called the Pool of Siloam. And to celebrate that at this festival, they used to bring the water up. And so, because that meant Jerusalem could be so much more secure, it had its own supply of water, and obviously water is fundamental to life. And so on the final day, Jesus comes in, and he stood up, verse 37, he stood up and with a loud voice, the ESV says, he cried out, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink." He's saying, "You want living water? I'm the living water. You come here to celebrate this festival. Those festivals talk about me." Jesus has come up on the last day because he wants to let people know. And what's more, what happens when you take that drink? Verse 38, "Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures said, rivers of living water," at the end of verse 38, "will flow from within them." Jesus is saying, you are going to be the one to produce that living water if you trust in him. You're going to take the living water on from Jesus and it's going to flow out from you. What does that mean? It means that Jesus is saying, if you want your friends to become Christians, he's hoping to use you. If you want your family to become friends, he wants you to be the ones that show him to them. We see that all over the world. Almost everyone we know who's become a Christian has become a Christian through a friend. Even in the Islamic world where we look today, where thousands are becoming Christian every day, about one in three people are partly becoming Christian, they say, because they're having a vision of Jesus. He's appearing to them and they're seeing him in brilliant white and they're feeling the presence of his love. But even then, with such huge numbers, that means two out of three people who become a Christian, aren't they doing so through their friends? Because Jesus says, you are going to come, verse 8, out of you the living water will flow. So what happens? Jesus continues to divide people. Verse 40, on hearing his words, some other people said, surely this man is the prophet, which is a reference to part of Deuteronomy, where it's the fulfillment. Others said, he is the Messiah, still others said, though, how can the Messiah come from Galilee? Does not the scripture say the Messiah comes from David's descendant? Have you noticed how a minute ago you couldn't know where the Messiah came from? But now they know he can't come from Galilee. They've started to engage with the text because they're engaging with Jesus. And yet still there's a kernel of truth and a kernel of untruth, isn't there? Some are believing, but those who aren't believing are doing so on the basis of untruth. 42, does not the scripture say that the Messiah will come from David's descendants and from Bethlehem? They're absolutely right. But the conclusion here is that can't be Jesus. Verse 17, you know if you follow, that can't be an accurate representation. Because of course we know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Not one of the greatest carols of Christmas, we'll sing about it a lot, on the little town of Bethlehem. But it's a simple misunderstanding, again used by Satan. You see, as we interact with these people, the question is, Jesus wants us to be that river, that flowing, but who does he want us for? I'll suggest to you verse 17, anyone. And verse 38, let anyone. The conclusion is that Jesus wants anyone and wants us to be that river of living water to be to all of those people. And it's not always easy, isn't it? Sometimes, especially to deal with some people, it's really hard. You know, we look at, say, these religious leaders here, and they seem to be so solidly against God, and it's easy in our own life, as we see maybe religious leaders, maybe people teaching what we would think to be falsehood, to be ready to be that living water. I find many cases my heart hardens. I flew with a guy just over a year ago, and he went to was partly attending a church where he had views very different to ours. He wasn't even convinced that the Bible is an accurate representation of what Jesus says. But we talked a lot about the Bible. But I'm not sure my heart was... I saw him more as an opposition rather than someone to give hope to. I remember on the last day we'd been away for a few days and he was really broken, struggling with life because he didn't have hope. And he said, do you know what? I bet you think there's no hope for me. I bet you think there's no hope. And I didn't have a great answer. I can't even remember what I said. And I remember a couple of days later thinking, oh, why didn't I just say everyone's got a hope? You know, everyone has a hope. And Jesus is saying, we're going to be the ones to provide that. The living water, verse 38. And so as we move on, we see that, don't we, Nicodemus is one of their own, but he starts to have his mind changed. There was a guy who lived in the 1200s called Peter Walday. You may know him. He was kind of an early reformer, well before the Reformation. He lived in France when he was converted and then moved a little bit to northern Italy. And it was obviously during the time when most of Europe was really quite Catholic. But he set up lots of groups of people to try and convert. And one of the groups he set up was to target kind of what would be known as like poorer people. He set up people, a group to kind of help evangelise to noble people. And he set up a guy just to evangelise the clergy. And it's easy, isn't it, to see all those groups maybe in different as opposition. But he led an absolutely fantastic life. It led to the martyrdom of many of the people that followed him. But we should be thinking about how we can use that. And so we see Nicodemus. As we start to see the move on to the final section, the unbelief of the Jewish leaders. 45, they sent the temple guards, a police officer, to arrest him. But even as they interacted with Jesus, they didn't bring him in. Verse 45 and 46, no one ever spoke in the way this man does. Can you imagine that? The local police officers today being sent out to arrest someone. They came back, Sergeant, we didn't arrest him. He was speaking so fantastically. Can you imagine it? It shows how powerful Jesus is speaking. That even in this culture, where often to disobey their rules would lead to significant punishment, they just couldn't touch Jesus because he was so powerful. And you see that division again. They saw Jesus. They've interacted with him and they started to respond. And yet what happens again? A lie. Nicodemus questions him, doesn't he? Verse 50 and 51. Does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what they've been doing? Nicodemus is talking about the law and truth. And they replied, verse 52, are you from Galilee too? Look into it and you will find that a prophet does not come out of Galilee. Notice how they don't respond with a question of the law. They respond, are you from Galilee too? Now, of course, again, they're trying to conclude, aren't they? Jesus can't be the Messiah. He can't be a prophet. He's come from Galilee. No one's ever done that. But of course, you know, verse 17, if you follow, it's not possible you can reach a conclusion like that. And in fact, these guys would have known they are lying, because it doesn't take much of a Google search to realise that some prophets have come out of Galilee, my favourite one being Jonah. They are openly lying, and they've reached that point as they divide, because they've reached their conclusion about what they want to do. So the question is, we see how these people are being divided. They're starting to interact with Jesus. But you see, many people are starting to believe. They're being turned into the source of life, the river of living water. And how is that going to be for us? You know, in our churches, we look around corporately in the UK today, we see not great numbers compared to what they used to. It was 1840 when the church reached a high point of attendance of about 42%. But how did they reach there? Well, they reached there because in about 1800, the church got seized by an absolute zeal to share the passion that they had for Jesus. They had an understanding of Christian commitment, got transformed by some key articles that really caught the church's attention. That the understanding of being a good Christian doesn't mean rocking up for your duty of 2 hours on a Sunday, but it meant that you were there in the rest of the week, on your weekends, instead of relaxing, you're working passionately. We saw a surge in the people giving away money to the poor. And yet, we as a church, we are really well equipped to do the same. We find that people in the UK really think really highly of Christians, in spite of what the media seems to say, or our own fears seem to think. We're afraid, aren't we, of getting challenged. Maybe we think that people think we don't like gay people as often a target, yet we find that in all surveys, no one hardly who knows us personally as Christians believe that. Only 6% of people who know a Christian person think that they don't like gay people. And that's 67% of the population in the UK know them, and 20% of those would like to know more about Jesus. And obviously, if you're good at maths, that makes you realise there's 7.5 million people in the UK who know one of us or a Christian in the UK and would like to be reading the Bible with us. And yet they're not, most of them. And so there's some people who've set up some great Bible studies, Word One-to-One, you may have heard of it. Lots of great stuff for you to read through the Bible with your friends. And they've done stuff where they've challenged people in groups. Every week for 20 weeks, ask one of your friends, would you like to meet up and read the Bible with me? And the guy who was leading the last conference I went to, he's reading the Bible currently with 5 people, 5 of his 20 friends. Friends wanted to meet up and read the Bible with him. That means if you play in a sports team, a football team, 2 to 3 of your mates want to read the Bible with you. You just don't know yet. Same for me and my hockey team. They're in our communities, these guys who want to. Jesus wants to turn us into this river of living water. That's the big call of this. Are we ready, though? Are we ready to make the sacrifices? The commitment to spread the gospel and to interact with our communities, it's costly in time, it's costly in effort, it's costly in money. You know, the time it takes to interact with lots of people is huge. You speak to loads of people who are doing that. You look and you see they're just half the time seeing 1 hour effort. One of the people I know just started a church in a council estate in Edinburgh. Half the time he seems to be talking about how he's cleaning up vomit out of his bathroom because of all the people that seem to come in with his open house. Are we ready to take those kind of people into our houses? Maybe we're ready, though, to protect ourselves. Maybe we hear the bad stories and we're not quite ready to be that flow of living water. We're not quite ready to interact with the people in the way that Jesus were. Find all the, maybe the prostitutes in the way that Jesus did. You know, maybe we're not ready to have that personal relationship. Who does woman wisdom call in Proverbs? She calls the drunkards, the adulterers, those fording out of the brothels at midnight or later, half undone still in their clothes. Are they the people we're getting into our houses to be the living water too? Radical grace and radical hospitality. That's what we need in the church if we're going to have people interact with Jesus. If we're going to be calling these people into our church and into our community, we need to open up our houses. Jesus says, I want you to become the living water. But maybe you're hearing this and thinking, I'm not even ready to become a trickle. I haven't got it. I don't feel it. Well, Jesus says, come to me and drink. You can't hope yet to become a river if you're not drinking in from Jesus. We see that in verse 37 and verse 38. Go and find the Christians and see them who are doing this hospitality to the max. The guys whose front doors are always open. They're always full of the people who are less desirable in our community, the ones who won't make great Sunday dinner guests. They're always spending their food. Their shopping bill is 20-30% higher because they're spending so much money on extra food to give out to poor people, to have people in for their houses. You ask them what their daily devotion is like, which what their Bible study group's like. They won't say things like, oh, I haven't managed to fit it in today. They won't say things like, I'm not in a Bible study group at the minute, I just don't have the time. I'm reading a book at the minute, I'm sure many of you are. The Gospel Comes with a Door Key. I know Pete's been giving it out to a few people. One thing you'll find, it's fundamental to people's lives who are doing active grace, active hospitality. The Bible is fundamental. Whenever they have people in, they always seem to be doing a Bible study. If you struggle with that, I do. Try and get a one-to-one partner. Maybe you're thinking it's a good idea. My life is full of great intentions that often never lived out. If you're thinking maybe I would like to get a one-to-one partner, do something about it today before we leave. My life's full of great intentions that never come to fruition. Try and seize the moment. My hope is, and I think Jesus' hope is really, we'll end with verse 31. Many in the crowd believe. Wouldn't that be great if we could say that as a church in Windsor? We look back years from now and we could say many believed.